5. Sunrise over the sea of grass was a thing of beauty. The consul watched from the highest point on the aft deck. After his watch, he had tried to sleep, given it up, and come onto deck to watch the night fade into day. The storm front had covered the sky with low clouds, and the rising sun lit the world with brilliant gold reflected from above and below. The wind wagon sails and lines and weathered planks glowed in the brief benediction of light in the few minutes before the sun was blocked by the ceiling of clouds and color flowed out of the world once again. The wind which followed this curtain closing was chill, as if it had blown down from the snowy peaks of the Bridal Range, just visible as a dark blur on the northeastern horizon. Braun Lamia and Martin Silenus joined the consul on the aft deck, each nursing a cup of coffee from the galley. The wind whipped and tugged at the rigging. Braun Lamia's thick mass of curls fluttered around her face like a dark nimbus.
"Morning,"
muttered Silenus, squinting out over his coffee cup at the wind-rippled sea of grass.
"Good morning,"
replied the consul, amazed at how alert and refreshed he felt for not having slept at all the night before.
"We have a headwind, but the wagon still seems to be making decent time. We'll definitely be to the mountains before nightfall."
"Mm-hmm,"
commented Silenus, and buried his nose in the coffee cup.
"I didn't sleep at all last night, just for thinking about M. Weintraub's story."
"I don't think,"
began the poet, and then broke off as Weintraub came onto deck, his baby peering over the lip of an infant carrier sling on his chest.
"Good morning, everyone,"
said Weintraub, looking around and taking a deep breath.
Brisk, isn't it?"
"Fucking freezing,"
said Silenus.
"North of the mountains it'll be even worse."
"I think I'll go down to get a jacket,"
said Lamia. But before she could move, there came a single, shrill cry from the deck below. "Blood!" There was, indeed, blood everywhere. Hetmastine's cabin was strangely neat. Bed unslept in, travel trunk and other boxes stacked precisely in one corner, robe folded over a chair. Except for the blood, which covered great sections of the deck, bulkhead, and overhead. The six pilgrims crowded just inside the entrance, reluctant to go farther in.
"I was passing on my way to the upper deck," said Father Hoyt, his voice a strange monotone. "The door was slightly ajar. I caught a glimpse of the blood on the wall."
"Is it blood?"
demanded Martin Silenus. Braun Lamia stepped into the room, ran a hand through a thick smear on the bulkhead, and raised her fingers to her lips.
"It's blood."
She looked around, walked to the wardrobe, looked briefly among the empty shelves and hangers, and then went to the small porthole. It was latched and bolted from the inside. Lenar Hoyt looked more ill than usual and staggered to a chair.
"Is he dead, then?"
"We don't know a damn thing, except that Captain Mastine isn't in his room, and a lot of blood is."
She wiped her hand on her pant leg.
"The thing to do now is search the ship thoroughly."
"Precisely,"
said Colonel Cassad.
"And if we do not find the captain?"
Braun Lamia opened the porthole. Fresh air dissipated the slaughterhouse smell of blood and brought in the rumble of the wheel and the rustle of grass under the hull.
"If we don't find Captain Mastine, then we assume that he either left the ship under his own will or was taken off."
"But the blood..."
"Doesn't prove anything. M. Lamia is correct. We don't know Mastine's blood type or genotype. Did anyone see or hear anything?"
There was silence, except for negative grunts and the shaking of heads. Martin Silenus looked around.
"Don't you people recognize the work of our friend the Shrike when you see it?"
"We don't know that. Maybe someone wanted us to think that it was the Shrike's doing."
"That doesn't make sense," said Hoyt, still gasping for air.
Nonetheless, we'll search in twos. Who has weapons besides myself?
I do,
said Colonel Cassatt.
I have extras if needed.
No, said Hoyt.
The poet shook his head. Saul Weintraub had returned to the corridor with his child. Now he looked in again.
I have nothing.
No,
said the consul. He had returned the death wand to Cassatt when his shift ended 2 hours before first light.
All right. The priest will come with me on the lower deck. Silenus, go with the colonel. Search the mid-deck. M. Weintraub, you and the consul check everything above. Look for anything out of the ordinary, any sign of struggle.
One question,
said Silenus.
What?
Who the hell elected you queen of the prom?
I'm a private investigator,
said Lamia, leveling her gaze on the poet. Martin Silenus shrugged.
Hoyt here is a priest of some forgotten religion. That doesn't mean we have to genuflect when he says mass.
All right,
sighed Braun Lamia.
I'll give you a better reason.
The woman moved so fast that the consul almost missed the action in a blink. 1 second, she was standing by the open port, and in the next she was halfway across the stateroom, lifting Martin Silenus off the deck with one arm, her massive hand around the poet's thin neck.
How about that you do the logical thing because it's the logical thing to do? Good,
said Lamia without emotion, and dropped the poet to the deck. Silenus staggered a meter and almost sat on Father Hoyt.
Here,
said Cassatt, returning with 2 small neural stunners. He handed one to Saul Weintraub.
What do you have?
Cassatt asked Lamia. The woman reached into a pocket of her loose tunic and produced an ancient pistol. Cassatt looked at the relic for a moment and then nodded.
Stay with your partner. Don't shoot anything unless it's positively identified and unquestionably threatening.
That describes the bitch I plan to shoot,
said Silenus, still massaging his throat. Braun Lamia took a half step toward the poet. Fedman Cassatt said,
Shut up. Let's get this over with.
Silenus followed the colonel out of the stateroom. Saul Weintraub approached the consul, handed him the stunner.
I don't want to hold this thing with Rachel. Shall we go up?
The consul took the weapon and nodded. The wind wagon held no further sign of Templar, Voice of the Tree, Het Mastin. After an hour of searching, the group met in the stateroom of the missing man. The blood there seemed darker and drier.
Is there a chance that we missed something? Said Father Hoyt. Secret passages? Hidden compartments?
There's a chance,
said Cassatt.
But I swept the ship with heat and motion sensors. If there's anything else on board larger than a mouse, I can't find it.
If you had these sensors, why the fuck did you have us crawling through bilge and byways for an hour?
Because the right equipment or apparel can hide a man from a heat and beat search.
So, in answer to my question, said Hoyt, pausing a second as a visible wave of pain passed through him, with the right equipment or apparel, Captain Mastin might be hiding in a secret compartment somewhere.
Possible, but improbable. My guess is that he's no longer aboard.
The Shrike,
said Martin Silenus in a disgusted tone. It was not a question.
Perhaps. Colonel, you and the consul were on watch through those 4 hours. Are you sure that you heard and saw nothing?
Both men nodded.
The ship was quiet. I would have heard a struggle even before I went on watch.
And I didn't sleep after my watch. My room shared a bulkhead with Mastin's. I heard nothing.
Well, we've heard from the 2 men who were creeping around in the dark with weapons when the poor shit was killed. They say they're innocent. Next case.
If Mastin was killed, it was with no death wand. No silent modern weapon I know throws that much blood around. There were no gunshots heard, no bullet holes found, so I presume M. Lamia's automatic pistol is not suspect. If this is Captain Mastin's blood, then I would guess an edged weapon was used.
The shrike is an edged weapon.
Lamia moved to the small stack of luggage.
Debating isn't going to solve anything. Let's see if there's anything in Mastine's belongings.
Father Hoyt raised a hesitant hand. That's, well, private, isn't it? I don't think we have the right. Brawn Lamia crossed her arms.
Look, Father, if Mastine's dead, it doesn't matter to him. If he's still alive, looking through this stuff might give us some idea where he was taken. Either way, we have to try to find a clue.
Hoyt looked dubious but nodded. In the end, there was little invasion of privacy. Mastine's first trunk held only a few changes of linen and a copy of Muir's Book of Life. The second bag held 100 separately wrapped seedlings, flash-dried and nestled in moist soil.
Templars must plant at least 100 offspring of the Eternal Tree on whatever world they visit,
explained the consul.
The shoots rarely take, but it's a ritual.
Brawn Lamia moved toward the large metal box which had sat at the bottom of the pile.
Don't touch that!
Why not?
It's a Mobius cube,
responded Colonel Cassad for the consul.
A carbon-carbon shell set around a zero-impedance containment field, folded back on itself.
So? Mobius cubes seal artifacts and stuff in. They don't explode or anything.
No, but what they contain may explode. May already have exploded, for that matter.
A cube that size could hold a kiloton nuclear explosion in check, as long as it was boxed during the nanosecond of ignition,
added Fedmon Cassad. Lamia scowled at the trunk.
Then how do we know that something in there didn't kill Mastine?
Cassad pointed to a faintly glowing green strip along the trunk's only seam.
It's sealed. Once unsealed, a Mobius cube has to be reactivated at a place where containment fields can be generated. Whatever's in there didn't harm Captain Mastine.
So there's no way to tell?
I have a good guess,
said the consul. The others looked at him. Rachel began to cry, and Saul pulled a heating strip on a nursing pack.
Remember at Edge yesterday, when M. Mastine made a big deal out of the cube? He talked about it as if it were a secret weapon.
A weapon?
A weapon.
Of course,
Cassad said suddenly.
An Urg.
Urg?
Martin Silenus stared at the small crate.
I thought Urgs were those force-field critters that Templars use on their tree ships.
They are. The things were found about 3 centuries ago, living on asteroids around Aldebaran. Bodies about as big as a cat's spine. Mostly a piezoelectric nervous system sheathed in silicon gristle. But they feed on, and manipulate, force fields as large as those generated by small spin ships.
So how do you get all that into such a little box?
Asked Silenus, staring at the Mobius cube.
Mirrors?
In a sense. The thing's field would be damped. Neither starving nor feeding. Rather like cryogenic fugue for us. Plus, this must be a small one, a cub, so to speak.
Lamia ran her hand along the metal sheath.
Templars control these things? Communicate with them?
Yes. No one is quite sure how. It's one of the Brotherhood's secrets. But Het Mastine must have been confident that the Urg would help him with...
The Shrike!
Finished Martin Silenus.
The Templar thought that this energy imp would be his secret weapon when he faced the Lord of Pain.
The poet laughed. Father Hoyt cleared his throat. The Church has accepted the hegemony's ruling that these creatures, Urgs, are not sentient beings, and thus not candidates for salvation.
Oh, they're sentient, all right, Father,
said the consul.
They perceive things far better than we could ever imagine. But if you mean intelligent, self-aware, then you're dealing with something along the lines of a smart grasshopper. Are grasshoppers candidates for salvation?
Hoyt said nothing. Brawn Lamia said,
Well, evidently Captain Mastine thought this thing was going to be his salvation. Something went wrong.
She looked around at the blood-stained bulkheads and at the drying stains on the deck.
Let's get out of here.
The wind wagon tacked into increasingly strong winds as the storm approached from the northeast. Ragged banners of clouds raced white beneath the low, gray ceiling of storm front. Grasses whipped and bent under gusts of cold wind. Ripples of lightning illuminated the horizon and were followed by rolls of thunder sounding like warning shots across the wind wagon's bow. The pilgrims watched in silence until the first icy raindrops drove them below to the large stateroom in the stern.
"This was in his robe pocket,"
said Braun Lamia, holding up a slip of paper with the number 5 on it.
"So Mastine would have told his story next,"
muttered the consul. Martin Silenus tilted his chair until his back touched the tall windows. Stormlight made his satyr's features appear slightly demonic.
"There's another possibility. Perhaps someone who hasn't spoken yet had the fifth spot and killed the Templar to trade places."
Lamia stared at the poet.
"That would have to be the consul or me,"
she said, her voice flat. Silenus shrugged. Braun Lamia pulled another piece of paper from her tunic.
"I have number 6. What would I have achieved? I go next anyway."
"Then perhaps it's what Mastine would have said that needed to be silenced,"
said the poet. He shrugged again.
"Personally, I think the Shrike has begun harvesting us. Why did we think we'd be allowed to get to the tombs when the thing's been slaughtering people halfway from here to Keats?"
"This is different," said Saul Weintraub. "This is the Shrike pilgrimage."
"So?"
In the silence that followed, the consul walked to the windows. Wind-driven torrents of rain obscured the sea and rattled the leaded panes. The wagon creaked and leaned heavily to starboard as it began another leg of its tack.
"M. Lamia, do you want to tell your story now?"
Lamia folded her arms and looked at the rain-streaked glass.
"No. Let's wait until we get off this damned ship. It stinks of death."
The wind wagon reached the port of Pilgrim's Rest in mid-afternoon, but the storm and tired light made it feel like late evening to the weary passengers. The consul had expected representatives from the Shrike Temple to meet them here at the beginning of the penultimate stage of their journey, but Pilgrim's Rest appeared to the consul to be as empty as Edge had been. The approach to the foothills and the first sight of the Bridal Range was as exciting as any landfall, and brought all 6 of the would-be pilgrims on deck, despite the cold rain which continued to fall. The foothills were sere and sensuous, their brown curves and sudden upthrustings contrasting strongly with the verdant monochrome of the sea of grass. The 9,000-meter peaks beyond were only hinted at by gray and white plains, soon intersected by low clouds, but even so truncated were powerful to behold. The snow line came down to a point just above the collection of burned-out hovels and cheap hotels which had been Pilgrim's Rest.
"If they destroyed the tramway, we're finished,"
muttered the consul. The thought of it, forbidden until now, made his stomach turn over.
"I see the first 5 towers,"
said Colonel Cassad, using his powered glasses.
"They seem intact."
"Any sign of a car?"
"No. Wait, yes. There's one in the gate at the station platform."
"Any moving?"
asked Martin Silenus, who obviously understood how desperate their situation would be if the tramway was not intact.
"No."
The consul shook his head. Even in the worst weather with no passengers, the cars had been kept moving to keep the great cables flexed and free of ice. The 6 of them had their luggage on deck even before the wind wagon reefed its sails and extended a gangplank. Each now wore a heavy coat against the elements, Kassad in force-issue thermoflage cape, Braunlamia in a long garment called a trench coat for reasons long forgotten, Martin Silenus in thick furs, which rippled now sable, now gray, with the vagaries of wind, Father Hoyt in long black, which made him more of a scarecrow figure than ever, Saul Weintraub in a thick goose-down jacket, which covered him and the child, and the consul, in the thinning but serviceable greatcoat his wife had given him some decades before.
"What about Captain Mastine's things?"
asked Saul as they stood at the head of the gangplank. Kassad had gone ahead to reconnoiter the village.
"I brought them up. We'll take them with us."
"It doesn't seem right somehow. Just going on, I mean. There should be some service, some recognition that a man has died."
"May have died,"
reminded Lamia, easily lifting a 40-kilo backpack with one hand. Hoyt looked incredulous.
"Do you really believe that M. Mastine might be alive?"
"No,"
said Lamia. Snowflakes settled on her black hair. Kassad waved to them from the end of the dock, and they carried their luggage off the silent wind wagon. No one looked back.
"Empty?"
called Lamia as they approached the colonel. The tall man's cloak was still fading from its gray and black chameleon mode.
"Empty."
"Bodies?"
"No,"
said Kassad. He turned towards Saul and the consul.
"Did you get the things from the galley?"
Both men nodded.
"What things?"
asked Silenus.
"A week's worth of food,"
said Kassad, turning to look up the hill toward the tramway station. For the first time, the consul noticed the long assault weapon in the crook of the colonel's arm, barely visible under the cloak.
"We're not sure if there are any provisions beyond this point."
"Will we be alive a week from now?"
thought the consul. He said nothing. They ferried the gear to the station in two trips. Wind whistled through the open windows and shattered domes of the dark buildings. On the second trip, the consul carried one end of Mastine's Mobius cube, while Lennar Hoyt puffed and panted under the other end.
"Why are we taking the Urk thing with us?"
gasped Hoyt as they reached the base of the metal stairway leading to the station. Rust streaked and spotted the platform like orange lichen.
"I don't know,"
said the consul, gasping for breath himself. From the terminal platform, they could see far out over the sea of grass. The wind wagon set where they had left it, sails reefed, a dark and lifeless thing. Snow squalls moved across the prairie and gave the illusion of whitecaps on the numberless stalks of high grass.
"Get the material aboard,"
called Kassad.
"I'll see if the running gear can be reset from the operator's cabin up there."
"Isn't it automatic?"
asked Martin Silenus, his small head almost lost in thick furs.
"Like the wind wagon?"
"I don't think so. Go on. I'll see if I can get it started up."
"What if it leaves without you?"
called Lamia at the colonel's retreating back.
"It won't."
The interior of the tram car was cold and bare, except for metal benches in the forward compartment, and a dozen rough bunks in the smaller rear area. The car was big, at least 8 meters long by 5 wide. The rear compartment was partitioned from the front cabin by a thin metal bulkhead with an opening but no door. A small commode took up a closet-sized corner of this aft compartment. Windows rising from waist height to the roof line lined the forward compartment. The pilgrims heaped their luggage in the center of the wide floor and stomped around, waved their arms, or otherwise worked to stay warm. Martin Silenus lay full length on one of the benches, with only his feet and the top of his head emerging from fur.
"I forgot. How the fuck do you turn on the heat in this thing?"
The consul glanced at the dark lighting panels.
"It's electrical. It'll come on when the colonel gets us moving."
"If the colonel gets us moving,"
said Silenus. Saul Weintraub had changed Rachel's diaper. Now he bundled her up again, in an infant's therm suit, and rocked her in his arms.
"Obviously I've never been here before. both of you gentlemen have?
Yeah,
said the poet.
No,
said the consul,
but I've seen pictures of the tramway.
Cassad said he returned to Keats once this way,
called Braun Lamia from the outer room.
I think,
began Saul Weintraub, and was interrupted by a great grinding of gears and a wild lurch as the long car rocked sickeningly and then swung forward under the suddenly moving cable. Everyone rushed to the window on the platform side. Cassad had thrown his gear aboard before climbing the long ladder to the operator's cabin. Now he appeared in the cabin's doorway, slid down the long ladder, and ran toward the car. The car was already passing beyond the loading area of the platform.
He isn't going to make it, whispered Father Hoyt.
Cassad sprinted the last 10 meters with legs that looked impossibly long, a cartoon stick figure of a man. The tram car slid out of the loading notch, swung free of the station. Space opened between the car and the station. It was 8 meters to the rocks below. The platform deck was streaked with ice. Cassad ran full speed ahead, even as the car pulled away.
Come on!
Screamed Braun Lamia. The others picked up the cry. The consul looked up at sheets of ice cracking and dropping away from the cable as the tram car moved up and forward. He looked back. There was too much space. Cassad could never make it. Fedmon Cassad was moving at an incredible speed when he reached the edge of the platform. The consul was reminded for the second time of the old earth jaguar he had seen in Alussis Zoo. He half expected to see the colonel's feet slip on a patch of ice, the long legs flying out horizontal, the man falling silently to the snowy boulders below. Instead, Cassad seemed to fly for an endless moment, long arms extended, cape flying out behind. He disappeared behind the car. There came a thud, followed by a long minute when no one spoke or moved. They were 40 meters high now, climbing toward the first tower. A second later, Cassad became visible at the corner of the car, pulling himself along a series of icy niches and handholds in the metal. Braun Lamia flung open the cabin door. 10 hands helped pull Cassad inside.
Thank God, said Father Hoyt.
The colonel took a deep breath and smiled grimly.
There was a dead man's break. I had to rig the lever with a sandbag. I didn't want to bring the car back for a second try.
Martin Silenus pointed to the rapidly approaching support tower and the ceiling of clouds just beyond. The cable stretched upward into oblivion.
I guess we're crossing the mountains now, whether we want to or not.
How long to make the crossing? Asked Hoyt.
12 hours. A little less, perhaps. Sometimes the operators would stop the cars if the wind rose too high, or the ice got too bad. We won't be stopping on this trip,
said Cassad.
Unless the cable's breached somewhere,
said the poet.
Or we hit a snag.
Shut up. Who's interested in heating some dinner?
Look, said the consul. They moved to the forward windows. The tram rose 100 meters above the last brown curve of foothills. Kilometers below and behind, they caught a final glimpse of the station, the haunted hovels of Pilgrim's Rest and the motionless wind wagon. Then snow and thick cloud enveloped them. The tram car had no real cooking facilities, but the aft bulkhead offered a cold box and a microwave for reheating. Lamia and Weintraub combined various meats and vegetables from the wind wagon's galley to produce a passable stew. Martin Silenus had brought along wine bottles from both the Benares and the wind wagon, and he chose a Hyperion Burgundy to go with the stew. They were nearly finished with their dinner when the gloom pressing against the windows lightened and then lifted altogether. The consul turned on his bench to see the sun suddenly reappear, filling the tram car with a transcendent golden light. There was a collective sigh from the group. It had seemed that darkness had fallen hours before, but now, as they rose above a sea of clouds from which rose an island chain of mountains, they were treated to a brilliant sunset. Hyperion's sky had deepened from its daytime glaucous glare to the bottomless lapis lazuli of evening, while a red-gold sun ignited cloud towers and great summits of ice and rock. The consul looked around. His fellow pilgrims, who had seemed gray and small in the dim light of half a minute earlier, now glowed in the gold of sunset. Martin Silenus raised his glass.
"That's better, by God."
The consul looked up at their line of travel, the massive cable dwindling to thread-like thinness far ahead, and then to nothing at all. On a summit several kilometers beyond, gold light glinted on the next support tower.
192 pylons,
said Silenus in a sing-song tour guide's bored tones.
Each pylon is constructed of duralloy and whiskered carbon and stands 83 meters high.
We must be high,
said Braun Lamia in a low voice.
The high point of the 96-kilometer tramcar voyage lies above the summit of Mount Dryden, the fifth highest peak in the Bridal Range, at 9,246 meters,
droned on Martin Silenus. Colonel Cassad looked around.
The cabin's pressurized. I felt the changeover some time ago.
Look.
The sun had been resting on the horizon line of clouds for a long moment. Now it dipped below, seemingly igniting the depths of storm cloud from beneath and casting a panoply of colors along the entire western edge of the world. Snow cornices and glaze ice still glowed along the western side of the peaks, which rose a kilometer or more above the rising tramcar. A few brighter stars appeared in the deepening dome of sky. The consul turned to Braun Lamia.
Why don't you tell your story now, M. Lamia? We'll want to sleep later, before arriving at the keep.
Lamia sipped the last of her wine.
Does everyone want to hear it now?
Heads nodded in the roseate twilight. Martin Silenus shrugged.
All right.
She set down her empty glass, pulled her feet up on the bench so that her elbows rested on her knees, and began her tale.